Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to the podcast. Ernest, you made your debut on BNN Market Call this week.
And I have to say thanks to all the podcast listeners who called in.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. Three or four people called in with questions. For those that don't know what we're talking about, Ernest was on BNN Bloomberg Market Call for an hour, answering viewer questions and emails about specific stocks, North American stocks. And we'll talk a little bit about that experience. We also have some big tech earnings that we want to review, and I think there's some meaningful stuff that came out of Apple and Amazon's reports. And I think there's some brighter times ahead for our trucking business, TFI International. And the concert business, there was a wild reaction to the stock price on day one, although I think that was overdone. And we want to talk why the concert business is essentially recession resilient. And before we get into that, let's get into this. This podcast, of course, is available on Spotify, on YouTube, and on Apple. Please subscribe. Please leave your reviews, preferably 5-star. That would help a lot. Comments, thumbs up, presence, anything you want to do to give us feedback, we appreciate it. Please, of course, Baskin Wealth Management, we manage money for high net worth clients across Canada, managing money for about 1,300 families. We have a team of 28 people, investments, wealth planning, estate planning, financial planning. You know, if you're not satisfied with your portfolio manager or you've hit a wall in terms of investing yourself and you want a second opinion, please reach out to us and we'd love to chat with you. And you can talk to me and Ernest and we'll go from there. So, Ernest, you seem to be dominating BNN. You were on twice last week, twice this week, as well as your debut on Market Call. I think I started doing the Market Call in 2011. So, and David was doing it from 2000. So a nice progression for our Baskin Wealth investment team, different faces on TV. But how was your experience? You went and they have a new studio, of course, BNN.
Yep. Yeah. So I think, so Market Call is the first time I ever sat there for an hour and answered questions from callers. Previously, I had only been doing short 5-minute segments where I basically provide top three names that we like.
Okay.
I think the difference, obviously, is that it's very different if you're talking about companies that you don't own, because naturally you're going to be less familiar with the story about some of these names. Like, for example, somebody wanted to ask me about MDA Space. Right. Very, very high level know what MDA Space does. But the reality is I'm not familiar with the business.
No,
we just never studied it.
You could never give a buy or sell recommendation to anyone.
Right.
You can, talk about the recent stock price movement or the recent news that may have caught your eye. But yes, it's pretty hard to, off the cuff, give an analysis in 2 seconds.
Yeah, and I think the other difference between BNN and a format such as this podcast is that it's a very quick take on stocks on BNN.
Yeah.
You're basically providing 1 to 2 lines summary of why you like or don't like the stock. Whereas for the podcast, we're able to talk. I'm able to talk as much as I want about stocks, kind of really going into the nuts and bolts in a way that you just can't do on a TV screen. So I think those are the main differences, but I had a great time and hopefully they have me back.
Yeah. And for those that don't know the magic of TV, they tell you in your ear which stocks you want to talk about beforehand.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it works. Mm-hmm. You don't have to. Yeah. So the way it works is that you sit there, During commercial breaks, they will ask you whether you want to answer questions about certain stocks or not. Mm-hmm. Now, I think people who are calling in because they want me or your specific opinion kind of already knows, hopefully, kind of already knows how we like to think about stocks.
Yeah.
They're not going to ask us about some Chinese startup tech company.
Fair enough.
You wouldn't reasonably expect that that's something that we know anything about, company. But I think we, as the theme is North American large caps, I think we hopefully can provide a useful or something for the listener to think about.
So when the questions were coming in, did you turn down a lot of questions on a specific sector or theme?
No, so that was...
Because that usually tells me what the public's interested in, right? So if there's a lot, if gold's doing well, there's going to be a lot of calls on gold.
No, so yeah. I think that was the helpful part on behalf of the listeners is that maybe because there were a lot of people who knew who I was from this podcast, they were calling in about companies that we frequently talk about.
Excellent.
And so there were not many questions that I had received about companies that I was completely unfamiliar with. I think that certainly helped my first time being on the show.
And your top picks when you're on BNN were?
Oh, yes. So my top picks were three Canadian compounders. So they were Constellation Software, CCL Industries, and Restaurant Brands. I think that, I don't know if we want to get into that right now.
No, but I think I'm going to urge people to check out your hit and Google it. It's on YouTube, of course.
It is on YouTube.
Yeah, so anybody following us, Ernest, maybe you put it up on Twitter that they can catch your appearance on YouTube.
But they are companies that I really think they're undervalued today. And it's not an investment recommendation, but we own all three of them. I think that better times are certainly coming for these companies, especially at the valuations that they're trading at.
Yeah. So in this day and age, when you can check your portfolio every 5 seconds, there's a lot of short-termism going around, right? Everybody knows price.
Yes.
You know, everybody can tell you that's, and it's amazing, you know, Twitter is sometimes a fun place, sometimes a very mean place. Everybody seems to know that, you know, when a stock goes down or misses earnings, that it was overvalued and you should have never bought it or you should have sold it. I mean, you know, there's no end to, you know, what do they call it? Sunday quarterbacks or Monday morning quarterbacks?
Yeah, so yeah. I've met a lot of great people on X and Twitter, but every time I go on, I almost regret it.
Yeah.
Because it's most likely just, you know, it's most likely just a short-term reaction to something that is completely unhelpful for a long-term investor, right? So last night, and we're recording this on Thursday, last night, DoorDash, they reported earnings, and we don't own DoorDash, but stock fell 20%.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody has a take.
Everybody has a take, yeah.
on why DoorDash is down 20%, right? So I think it's, if you're a long-term investor, I think there's certainly a lot of very smart people you can interact with on Twitter, but it's best just to take a step back, really focus on kind of what the companies are doing, because most likely it's just noise.
I really want to reiterate how not very relevant 1 year's performance is to a company if you intend to hold it for a long period of time. Right. So, you know, this is a little getting in the weeds, but the price of a stock should be the discounted value of all future cash flows over a long period of time, not just 90 days.
Right.
Right. So even and the perfect example is Live Nation that we use that we're going to talk about today. Live Nation had zero business during the pandemic.
Yes.
Zero. The only thing important was, can it stay alive for when the world reopens, and it did. Had you reacted to the pandemic holding Live Nation stock from 60, I think it dropped to $20 a share, whatever it was, you know, that would have been horrific. But now the stock is $130, $140 a share. So, and the bottom line is, if your stock falls 20% after missing an earnings expectation or your guide isn't as good, you can't learn anything from that. You can't learn anything from a 10 or 20% drop in the market. Maybe the markets have gone up too much. Maybe stock price, like we are in a bull market, right? So disappointments do lead to maybe more dramatic pullbacks when the earnings are not up to perfection.
Right. And especially for a company like Live Nation, where we've owned the company for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Well, like I think eight years or so.
I think since 2015.
Yeah. It's been a while. So having kind of observed the things that the market generally gets worried about this company, kind of looking at how the company ends up reacting to these things, right? It gives, like, so Live Nation again, like they reported earnings and I think the stock fell like 8%.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it fell 10% at the end of the day.
Yeah. But realizing, having seen this before and realizing that it's more likely just, not that we're not paying attention to the company, but realizing that it's most likely something short-term that the market is worried about that doesn't really have anything to do with the long-term kind of growth prospects of the business. And so that's kind of what gives us conviction to continue holding and maybe even buy more.
And the market, when I say the market, it's investors, can be right or wrong in the short term. But it's meaningless. So I'll give you another example, right? Google, which is now up 50% this year and up 80% from its lows only a year ago, right? The narrative was it's not a good business, it's losing in search, blah, blah, blah. The market was completely wrong there.
Yes.
Right? And so when you call up or when you pull up your portfolio, and you see an underperformer or something that hasn't moved in 3 years, or my God, that was a $500 stock, now it's a $300 stock. What are we doing about it? If the we're going to keep hitting the nail on the head. If we believe in the fundamentals, if we believe in the story and the quality of the business, chances are the right thing to do is buy more.
Right.
And be patient, right? And so that's the strategy. I've gotten a call from a client this year, well, we're not doing as well as index A, B, or C. Okay, what are we doing about it? Right. I'm not doing anything about it because, performance over the long term is based on earnings growth over the long term.
Yep.
And if I knew how to get in and out of the hot stocks, then I would do that. But I what makes us comfortable is investing for the long term in good businesses and ignoring the narrative of the day. And so, we keep reiterating these points, but it's true. And this is my 25th year doing this, being in this business. And, the market sometimes gets it right, sometimes gets it wrong. But ultimately, we're going to trust the fundamentals, trust our research, trust our judgment. We always appreciate our clients' feedback. People on Twitter's feedback, your feedback. You can tell us we're stupid or smart. We'll take it. The bottom line is the 1 year performance or the 6 months performance, it just tells you how you've done over the last 6 months. It gives you zero indication how you're going to do going forward. Those that are so giddy and happy because they own some non-profitable AI stocks or gold stocks may look very, very dumb 6 months from now. Or not. It's very hard to know. So why am I bringing this all up? I'm bringing this up because I'm very confident about our portfolio. I spent the weekend looking, because we had a lot of stocks who reported good earnings and like the stocks didn't react or went down. I feel even better about our companies as we head into 2026 versus 2025. I think the worries about the big tariffs are over. I think the fact that interest rates are coming down, the fact that inflation seems to be more stable, the fact that corporate earnings are very, very strong. And most importantly, the stocks that we like, the profitable stuff, hasn't yet caught up to the performance of some of the crazy stuff. And so that gives us even more excitement that these companies are very undervalued. And when people decide to rotate back to sensible businesses, I think some of our companies are like a coiled spring. And I'm hopeful that some of the things that our companies are facing, whether it's in the trucking business or in the being hurt by the low-income consumer, maybe some of those things will start to fade away as the economy does well or as interest rates come down. Hard to know, but that's where we're at today. Yeah. Any comments on my little rant there?
I thought that was very well said.
Okay. So talking about a stock that we've held for a very, very long time. Everybody knows we're Apple fanboys here. My house, every single one of us at the Schwartz household has Apple products, and we are just addicted. And once you buy one, the ecosystem continues to grow around you. Whether we're paying more for cloud storage, whether we're downloading apps, whether we're losing AirPods and buying new ones.
Yep.
And they don't last very long either, right?
Well, I'm not an Apple ecosystem user.
Yeah, I'm talking a wall here.
But
yeah.
My wife certainly is, and I definitely know how often these things get replaced.
She's an Apple user. What Apple products does she?
Yeah, so she's in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
It's AirPods, Mac, iPhone, mm-hmm. iPad. Mm-hmm. It's the full suite.
So you're an Android user. Do you have the Android ecosystem? Do you have Android earbuds and Android iPad?
Well, it's different, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Because Android is not a platform. Mm-hmm. When Google makes Android phones, right? Like Google primarily is an advertising business.
Yes.
Now they're trying to make good phones, but they're not trying to integrate the products to the same degree that Apple is. So I do have a Pixel watch,
yeah.
which I don't really use because it's a fairly mediocre product.
Why did you buy it?
Came for free. Got it for free.
There you go.
I got it for free. I have my Pixel phone,
yeah.
which is fine. Like I don't have any. I'm not going to give a tech review, but I don't think it is blowing me away. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I haven't switched to the ecosystem, Apple ecosystem, is just once you've kind of built your digital profile on Android or iOS. It turns out it's very, very hard to switch
because
you know all your apps are already there. Like I'm using Google Pay, and like all my photos are on my Google profile, and to have to switch all of that to iPhone is just too much work.
You're too lazy. Not worth it.
Yeah.
All right. So Apple's earnings. Right. Apple reported Apple stock at an all-time high. Recently, Apple reported a nice earnings beat. More importantly, it gave strong guidance for the December quarter, right?
Yep.
And so the iPhone started going on sale end of September, early October. I think this was for
17.
Yeah, so this was for the quarter end, September 30th, of course. So it wasn't like that many iPhones were sold.
Yep.
They say they're supply constrained for some versions of iPhones, and they're seeing... And they expect profitable sales in China, right? China sales to grow.
Yep. So it's a very strong quarter. Device sales were up for most categories. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a few ways to look at this. Number one is that there's not really evidence that consumers are preferring to switch away to Google phones or Samsung mm-hmm. or whatever, even though you can use ChatGPT or AI services on mm-hmm. Other platforms, mm-hmm. right? So that was one of the fears that people had about Apple.
You can use ChatGPT and Gemini on your Apple iPhone too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially because they had the AI features that they were talking about. So like the AI-powered Siri and Apple Intelligence, like I think these were... to say they were a disappointment would be an understatement, mm-hmm. right? So people still love their iPhones and are willing to buy them. I think there is a simpler explanation for why they're suddenly seeing a sales acceleration, which is that if you look back roughly 4 years or so, that was 2021 mm-hmm. when everyone was stuck at home, everyone was... for whatever reason, they were rich
yeah.
and buying new devices. And so now after 4 years, they want to replace them.
Of course.
And so I think that some of the growth that you're seeing is just kind of a natural replacement cycle of the products that people were buying. Mm-hmm. But it's good to see that they're on the right track.
Now, as for pricing, Apple didn't really increase pricing on its phones, correct? Right?
They launched, so they kind of did, mm-hmm. by cutting out the, for the Pro, they cut out the lower
tier
of, okay. With less memory. Mm-hmm. They added a new product. So like they added the Air, which is kind of a totally separate thing. Mm-hmm. And no response to that has been mixed. Mm-hmm. But more importantly is that I think looking ahead to 2026, I think they're going to launch, at least the rumors are, that they're going to launch a foldable phone and, you know, like really expanding on the formats
your,
that way.
Your
as
take
well.
On a foldable phone? I think they're gimmicky, but...
Well, I think that I don't know anyone who personally has a
foldable
phone.
I know one friend, his wife has it.
Yeah.
I guess it's a Samsung or whatever, and I don't know, it looks weird.
I think that... So whether they're
gimmicky foldable, or... It's foldable like this, right? It doesn't go this way.
So I think people will buy it it's an Apple one, right?
Yeah.
Where I think a frequent pattern for Apple is that they'll launch a product, it'll be a hit just because it's Apple.
Yeah.
People who use Android devices will complain that this was invented by somebody else a long time ago and that Apple was not innovating and just merely copying that company. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change the fact that, you know, Apple was able to make a superior version of it and drive sales.
Key insights in the quarter, things that caught your mind?
Yeah, so one thing is that services is now a $100 billion business.
That's insane.
Yep. Yeah. So services, there's a few things that fall under this.
And Apple's a $400 billion revenue company, correct?
I'll give roughly.
So one quarter is
services. Roughly. But services is much higher margin. And I think that's one of the reasons why the stock has... It kind of trades at the multiple that it does because it's increasingly a recurring revenue business and less of a, you know, kind of a device consumer hardware company, right? So I think part of the driver of this is that due to the Google antitrust case, they're allowed to continue paying Apple for search, right? And so... that's one of the things that is notable.
And we saw some, I'm not sure it was confirmed, but rumors that Apple will be working with Gemini, Google's Gemini, for its updated version of AI, Siri AI, starting next year. Apple promises to launch, to tell the investors in March of 2026 how Siri is going to start providing more AI features. A lot riding on this because Apple, you know, pooped the bed with their AI Apple Intelligence in 2025. Is there any reason to think that 2026 there'll be incremental improvements? Hard to know.
So I think the news is that they're paying about $1 billion to Google for using Gemini to power Siri, which is kind of insane considering like how much money Google has spent really to train up these models. And Apple's able to get it for $1 billion a year, which is...
It's a win-win.
Which is basically lunch money for you and me, right? And so, you know, I think that Apple has always been very good at knowing what parts that they need to control and what parts they can rely on third parties to use, right? So, like, even on your iPhone, not every single thing that you do is... provided by Apple.
No, of course not.
Use a lot of third-party products, right? And so I think that AI is one of those things where, for now at least, they don't view owning the large language models, like the ChatGPT and Gemini-type models, as being something that is essential, at least to spend the money that other companies are spending on.
Best to be a distributor with a private label wrapper on it.
Right.
And that's the deal that... Not confirmed, of course, but Apple, assuming we'll get the ChatGPT version of Gemini to help Siri, and of course that should lead to more traffic for Google.
Right.
So the amount of money that Apple is paying is not economic to either companies, But this could be a really economic win-win deal for both companies if it works out, if people start using the Siri more and referring back to Google Gemini.
Yeah, I think from Apple's perspective, this is mostly just an incremental service that they're going to be rolling out to their users, where you might find your iPhone being a little bit more useful to you because now you can use the Siri. But I don't think anybody is going to switch from...
Sure.
It's not going to drive market share.
And Apple has not given up on its other projects. So, of course, the Vision glasses, not a huge hit, but they're looking to rework that. There's rumors that they're working on some kind of robotic arm for the house, as well as other home automation features.
Yep.
And we'll just see how it goes. Apple wants to be the world leader in many different big markets, whether it's healthcare, robotics, financial services, and of course, you know, entertainment and what have you. And so far doing a wonderful job. So the stock has moved up very nicely. The recurring revenue is there, the gigantic free cash flow. Company gave very strong guidance, and that's why you're seeing the reaction to that. Amazon, of course, reported earnings. This is one where Amazon has kind of sat there like a bump on the log for quite a long time. Another one where, you know, you could have looked at it and said, my God, that stock's not doing anything. Get rid of it. Or, you know, it's losing in AI. And then all of a sudden, it reports an extremely strong quarter. You had to read through the quarter because there were some adjusting items. I think it had paid a big tax bill.
Yep.
They had a regulatory fine. Yeah.
Yep.
But if you exclude that, the operating income was up very strongly. It looks the day before they made the earnings announcements, they also laid off a bunch of people too. Kind of suspect, but it's nothing new in terms of what Andy Jassy, the CEO, has been saying for years, is that we're going to improve our operations. We're going to lower our costs. We're going to have AI do a lot of think tasks that humans are doing. And hopefully, you're going to start seeing that in the margins going forward. In the meantime, of course, unlike Apple, Amazon's spending, what, $120 billion on CapEx?
Yep.
And probably more in 2026. For those that don't know, Amazon has a gigantic cloud and AI division, as well as its retail division, as well as it's in everything.
Yep.
So insights, Ernest, that you learned from Amazon during the quarter.
Yeah, so there were a lot of worries going into the earnings that they were losing share. AWS was losing market share to Azure and Google especially. Mm-hmm. And I think that this quarter kind of put a rest to that, where AWS revenues grew faster than they did the prior quarter, and specifically attributed that to growth in AI. And then after the earnings, they signed a deal with OpenAI, where they would, you know, provide some computing capacity for OpenAI as well.
Today or in the future?
I think it's immediately.
Yeah.
So that's very good news for AWS. Mm-hmm. I think kind of more interesting on the retail side is that I think the retail business is the one that kind of touches people on a daily basis, but is not really talked about enough from an investment perspective. But this business is today as good as it's ever been from a customer perspective. So I think they said they're starting to launch 3-hour delivery in many cities, right? Which is just insane if you think about it.
Well, in Toronto, it takes 3 hours to get from one end of the city to the next. I don't even know how they promise 3-hour delivery, but that's another story.
So speeds are as good as they've ever been. Mm-hmm. The business is as profitable as it's ever been.
The margins on retail were very good.
Yeah, they have 7% margin today.
So this was one I remember reading years ago where people were saying, Amazon's never going to make money on retail.
Yep.
They're gonna lose money forever. 7% margins are not fantastic, but retail is not a fantastic business to begin with, right?
No, this is not a business that you're going to expect very high margins from. The value from a well-run retail business, as with Costco, is very fast asset turnover and low margins, because that's what ultimately keeps people coming back. And so that's what we're seeing with Amazon, where
it's very Costco-like, right? Reinvesting
to
do everything great for the consumer, not necessarily for the shareholder in the short term, but if you do everything great for your customers in the short, medium, and long term, it should translate into tremendous stock price.
Yeah, I think the thing that was interesting was they noted very good growth in groceries this quarter, perishable groceries. Mm-hmm. And this is really, I think the reason why they're starting to succeed in this is because of all the effort that they've done over the last 3 years to fix up and improve the efficiency of their delivery network. And so what they're seeing is that people are now wanting to buy milk, they want to buy lettuce, because they're able to deliver in same day. And more importantly is that when people are ordering groceries, they're buying other stuff as well. So a lot of good things that they're doing there.
Awesome. Awesome. And you were talking about this Amazon launching this Buy For Me. What is this?
Right. Another thing that Amazon has kind of been talking about is the use of AI within their retail business. And so similar to Meta, they're one place that they're doing this is that they are allowing the advertisers, so the third-party sellers, to use AI to create ads and make it more, make it easier for them to sell things on Amazon. But on the consumer side, launching things like they launched a AI shopping assistant where they're seeing some early good results that are leading to higher probability that you're end up purchasing something. And then they also talked about something called Buy For Me, where it's if there's a product that you're looking for and Amazon or its third-party sellers doesn't have that product, it will actually scour the web for you and find a merchant that does have that product and then fulfill it to you.
You'll pay Amazon who will fulfill it to you,
right? Yeah, you'll buy it through Amazon.
You buy it through,
through whether it's an AI agent or whatever. And so I think this is really, we'll see how material this ends up being, but I think it's a really good demonstration of Amazon's strength, right? Which is that when you go to Amazon to shop, it's not that you're looking for a specific item, right? Like, and if you don't find it, then you go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You kind of naturally trust that Amazon already has that product. And so Amazon is really leveraging this to drive themselves as the main place that you look when you are shopping for things.
These companies are proof that AI is definitely working,
right?
There's no doubt about it. They're seeing better conversions on sales. Meta talks about it. Amazon talks about it. People are signing up and paying for these tools and not canceling. It's happening. But when you have these transformational events, there's always going to be the risk of overbuild, of running into cash crunches, of slowdowns. But we're just seeing the results still so early. So many companies on our conference calls have talked about, we're unsure if it's word salad or it's actually true, of course. But companies are talking about the benefits of using AI to help with payments, logistics, routing, ordering, following up with customers, customer service. And this is still stupid AI.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So TFI International, I think this was the quarter where you can start to get excited and see the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't think you'll see it in the results for two or three more quarters. But with TFI, the results, you're going to get into it, but a number of good things are happening. Supply of truckers seems to be coming off. Spot pricing seems to be getting tighter. Hopefully the deal that US and China are signing could make trade a little more active. Interest rates are coming down, which could help the economy. The economy's doing good. I mean, there's a lot of things that could see this horrible freight recession that a lot, it's not just TFI, that a lot of the truckers and LTL companies are going through right now, probably hit bottom in the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah. So it was actually a pretty bad quarter.
Yeah.
all things put together, but the market was not surprised by this because we've been in a freight recession for basically 3 years now.
Yeah, brutal.
Where in 22, everybody added capacity because there was a shortage of truckers. And then right when that capacity got added on, tariffs and industrial activity started to drop. So now we're in a situation where there's way too many truckers and not enough freight. And that's kind of the situation that... And within that backdrop is that TFI was still working to fix up at TForce Freight, which is the UPS business that they acquired. And so that's kind of the big picture on why the stock has done so poorly this year.
Well, the earnings have not come in, right?
Right.
So the earnings this year will be around $4 or $5 US a share versus $8 US a share a couple of years ago, right? That's a material drop. But what gives us comfort that the earnings won't be $5 forever?
No, like Q4 was, and Q4 is going to be pretty bad as well.
They already pre-announced.
The shutdown is still happening as we speak, which is impacting their Department of Defense business. They have a big business that moves trucks, so trucks moving trucks. Mm-hmm. That business is basically not zero, but down like 50%.
Yeah.
And so...
Because of the shutdown?
No, it's just because of no one needs to order trucks.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so the whole environment is not very good. But I think what I think people are excited about is that on the one hand, things might get better in 2026, hopefully, right? Like, you know, you never know. Yeah. But what we're seeing is that because of the prolonged freight recession, there's a lot of smaller truckers that are... and logistics companies that are starting to shut down. Mm-hmm. They're going bankrupt. They're laying off workers. So supply is coming off. There are some new driver rules, especially in the US, about things like English proficiency and you having to be a citizen to be able to drive.
Yeah,
I think some people think that might be a material reduction in the number of truck drivers.
In the United States?
Yep. So... And then lastly, there's some good things going on with hopefully some of the tariff worries might come off. Hopefully the big beautiful bill that was kind of designed to drive infrastructure spending starts to really drive that, especially since infrastructure is or industrial activity is a large user of LTL trucking services. And then on TFI's side, they've really been making efforts to focus on the controllables. So, for example, reducing the number, like making sure that they're on time to pick up the goods, right? Making sure that they're not, their drivers are not crashing as much, right? Stuff like that, right? And making sure that they are billing properly. So these kind of, really on the ground type operational things, which... And so as they're providing better service, this will allow them to raise prices and because they're providing better service. So that's, and set them up for better performance when the market improves.
What's so fascinating about TFI is even in a year where it's having bad results all around, the company raised its dividend a second time this year. Boy, oh boy, if there's not a signal, that's a great signal. Management seeing tough times this year, but hey, we're generating so much free cash flow because, as using your word, controlling the controllables, as well as it's an excellent, well-run business. And even in the worst freight recession, extremely profitable and gushing cash. And I think the expectation is around $700 million US this year of free cash flow.
Yep.
Excess capital, and it's been using it to buy back stock aggressively and another dividend increase. It probably doesn't want to make major acquisitions at this time, given the uncertainty of the whole economy, but I'm sure it's looking and talking to lots of people. And if there's a sign that things are going to improve, it might be all over M&A again.
Yeah, we'll see about that. I think it's tougher for them to make a big deal today, given where the stock price is, because I think one thing that we like about TFI is that they're outstanding capital allocators. Mm-hmm. And so it's whether they use the cash to buy back stock or whether they use it to go and make a deal, it's all kind of relative to what is most attractive at that time. Mm-hmm. And so given the stock price is so cheap today, they've talked a lot that it's hard for them to do a deal that is more attractive than buying back stock. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we want to see, right? Is a management that kind of understands this dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And so the final company we're going to talk about today is Live Nation. We talked about it at the beginning, Live Nation, we've owned that stock for about 10 years. It is a concert promoter as well as owning Ticketmaster. As a result of a merger of those two companies, which the government obviously regrets many, many years later. The company, of course, had a big, big 2024. Taylor Swift was touring. The tickets were moving hot. This year, there's no Taylor Swift, but there is Oasis. There are other, bands that are touring, but it's still a strong year for Live Nation, but maybe not as robust as it thought it would be at the start of the year. That said, Michael Rapino, the CEO, gave some very good confidence to investors about the upcoming year, 2026. He feels there's a number of big artists who just, who didn't tour or rested in 2025 that will be on the docket for 2026. And already it's showing up in the deferred revenue results.
And 2025 was not even a bad year.
No.
Ticket sales are up double digits.
Yeah. So what's wrong with that?
It's not like it's a bad year.
No.
But
this is the market we're in, right? If you think it's going to do 10% revenue growth and it does 9%, take it out and shoot it. Even though anybody doing 9% revenue growth in an economy where GDP grows 2 or 3% is amazing. But, that's the deal this year with a lot of companies.
Yeah. There's been a bit of an overhang, as there always has been for Live Nation from a regulatory perspective, where this quarter there was the FTC filed a lawsuit against their practices in the secondary market, mm-hmm. where what they're saying is that, and I think this is kind of a popular misconception about Ticketmaster, where a lot of people think that Ticketmaster does is that they're allowing bots to buy and scalpers to take up all the tickets, let's say the Blue Jays, so that they can earn twice the revenue on the scalp.
Not
right?
True.
And so I think that Live Nation gave a very kind of strong defense about this, where they said basically, look, like secondary for us is like low single digit percentage of our revenues. Mm-hmm. Like they just don't care about it, right? And the overarching objective for Live Nation to begin with is that they want to get rid of the secondary to ensure that the artists are making the money and not the scalpers.
That's right.
Right. That's kind of the whole big picture objective that they're looking for.
That's right.
But
in some sense, they have to encourage the artists to do more dates, concert dates. Maybe at larger stadiums, but it's Live Nation's goal to fill the seats, and they want customers in there so they can sell sponsorship and advertising and beer and parking and T-shirts and a whole bunch of other crap that people buy when they go to events.
And I think the reality of, say, something like the World Series. Right. The reality of this event is that the Rogers Stadium is only so big.
Yeah.
It can only hold 40,000 people.
Yeah.
Right. So somebody is like, just kind of by its nature, not everybody's going to be able to attend, especially at the price that is affordable to everyone. Yeah. Somebody's going to have to be disappointed. And so I think one of the things that Ticketmaster historically has done is kind of taken this role as the big bad enemy for everybody to hate on, so that they can deflect the blame and kind of reduce heat from the artists, from the sports teams.
The bad actors are the resellers. And so the way to solve it is to come up with some kind of dynamic pricing where people don't feel they're being screwed too much on the ticket prices, but also can get access to them at a price point that makes sense versus paying $10,000 to go watch the Blue Jays in a World Series.
No, and it turns out that it's an extremely difficult job to reduce scalping.
Yeah.
Because they're extremely sophisticated. And a lot of the things that people hate about Ticketmaster today, things like verified fan, right? Things like they have this new face ID verification process. All of these things are done because of the bots. Mm-hmm. And so I don't view Live Nation as the bad actor here. Like, I think they're, in many cases, they're actually kind of leading the industry in trying to solve these issues. Mm-hmm. But the unfortunate part for them is that because of this widespread public perception of the company, it does bring regulatory issues over time.
For sure. Any insights as to anything that they're using in terms of AI or technology to try and improve pricing or ticket sales or what have you?
Yep. So one thing that they did announce is that now you can, they partnered with Google where you can buy tickets through Google AI mode, mm-hmm. right? So being able to provide different ways for you to buy tickets. So that's kind of an added service that they're providing for the venues and for concert events. I think beyond that, they held an investor event where kind of the main focus of the event was on Venue Nation, really focusing on building out the venues that they own. So not just providing the ticketing and bringing the artists.
How many venues does Live Nation own about?
I don't remember the exact number, but the increasing number of shows that they're having are coming from Live Nation owned venues, mm-hmm. where these are purpose built for music.
Or acquired.
So unlike Rogers Center, which is kind of made for sports, right? Building a purpose built music facility that has all the facilities and all the, the setup and the stages and things for musicians.
Without holdbacks because, Blue Jays and football, everything is playing at the Rogers Center. You want to have free nights. And so if you own it, you can book whatever you want.
They make good money on these because they're able to bring the artists to tour in some places that they might not have otherwise. They're earning the popcorn, they're earning the beer, they're earning the parking. And then from a regulatory perspective, and I think this is really the key, is that it insulates the business from whatever regulatory outcome the antitrust situation might have. Mm-hmm. Because if you own the venue, you can't dictate to yourself that you can't use Ticketmaster.
Yeah, right? You own it.
Yep. Yeah. So I think the management has done a really good job on that front, mm-hmm. and we continue to own it.
Very good. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see you back here real soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.